The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Today, drama at Old Trafford, Emirates and beyond. Football Weekly has the questions that matter. Red for Vincent, the worst company card decision since Barry at the beer clinic. Jonathan Waters at Stoke, if he'd scored the penalty, could he have kept the match ball? And Wenger plus Coat, is he a dead ringer for hookah-smoking caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland, or what? Also today, Daniel Sturridge, what he can teach you about frowning. Barcelona, that messy pass for Fabregas, post-tweets. And this weekend's real Super Sunday clash wasn't in the Premier League or the Liga or Serie A. We'll have more later. All that and more in today's Football Weekly. All right, with a voice like silk stockings thrown across a shag park carpet, it's Amy Lawrence. Hi, Amy.
I can't possibly say hello after that.
Right.
Hello.
Hi. Soft-talking, tough-tackling former Blackburn man Greg Bukowski.
Hi, James.
All right, you all right?
I'm okay, yeah.
And with a finely tuned nose for fact-filled conversation that comes from a childhood's pit with his hand up a cow's bum.
Hello.
It's Barry Glendenning. Oh, I got this in the wrong order. All right, anyway, yeah. Yes, good. Here's a post, or a tweet perhaps, from Sahar Sadiq, who says, who feels worse this Monday morning, Amy or Greg? Which is it?
I'd say Amy. I just had a little conversation. She seemed miles more depressed than me.
What did the man behind you, because you were there, what did the man behind you say when Koscielny got the red card?
Well, that's a game gone for every f*** on the planet.
Including the ones who'd paid 62 quid to see it.
Yeah, no, I mean, to be honest, I think when you try and assess it, it's one of those things where people turn around and say, oh, early sending off, it's a pity, isn't it? It's nothing to do with whether it's a pity or not.
Right.
If the action that makes it happen is worthy of a sending off, it's just one of those things you've got to take. And unfortunately for Koscielny, who I think last season was arguably Arsenal's most consistent defender, he's had a pretty miserable time of it this year. And you just have to ask yourself, I'm not quite sure what he was doing, but a player of his experience shouldn't really be doing something like that in a big game so early on.
Well, someone tweeted it would have been a foul in rugby, let alone football. But there are many teams who have played better with 10 men than 11. Sampdoria just last weekend won at Juventus with 10 men, came back from a goal down. Arsenal, though, perhaps not one of those teams.
No, I'd say Arsenal are probably the least equipped team of a sort of aspiring big team to manage well in that situation. And they just haven't got the organisation, really. And I was thinking back of what I'd written early on in the season about Steve Bould coming in and transforming the Arsenal defence, which after three games seemed like a perfectly reasonable thing to say. But obviously it doesn't really look to have had a long-lasting effect. And they're just not geared up to cope with, well, sometimes with 11 men in terms of their defending.
Yeah, do you
defending.
Think it would have been any different? Sorry.
You can't expect an Arsenal team who really have one way of playing. For years, people have been going on about this lack of a plan B. And I don't think that they've got the nous and collectively to organise themselves. And I don't think they certainly don't practice that way. You know, there are certain teams who actually practice a lot with playing with 10 men.
And they haven't got, you were saying before, Alex Song, somebody like who can come in and try and at least win the ball back and help out in a situation like that. And
I think a lot has been said, obviously, about Van Persie's departure and the implications, although I did see somewhere that Arsenal have apparently scored more goals than they had at this time last year. But very little is said about Alex Song's departure. And although in some people's minds he wasn't, you know, the definitive holding defensive midfield player, he definitely would have added something to a situation like yesterday's. I think the other thing to bear in mind is to give City some credit. Sorry, I'm banging on here. But again, going back to this, sendings off change games scenario.
Yeah, I mean, would it have made any difference against City?
I think more to the point, you know, this was almost, the sending off happened for two reasons. One was that Man City were really playing very well. They started off passing the ball around beautifully. Arsenal looked, you know, under pressure, not quite sure how to handle it, not able to get a foothold in the game. And City looked very interesting, I thought, and Arsenal, with a classic self-destruct button kind of defensive mistake, It shaped the game. It wasn't something that happened purely by accident. It happened because City were so good and because Arsenal are prone to this kind of thing.
The defending for Milner's goal on the free kick, there was five Arsenal defenders who weren't even looking at the ball. They were kind of looking, one was looking one way, one was looking behind them. And it's like they were waiting for a bus or something. And then before you know it, the goal had been scored. And it's like you really can't afford that kind of, I don't even know if it's naivety, just kind of lack of concentration against a team, particularly when you've just gone down to 10 men.
Now, Koscielny wasn't the only man who saw red, of course. There was the sending off of Vincent Kompany, which has had people all over the place up in arms. Yay or nay, should he have gone, Barry?
I can see both sides of the argument, right, to be honest. Mm. He probably could have got away with a yellow card, or possibly even no card at all. But he has been sent off for a similar tackle before against Manchester United, I think. And so he knows what the likely outcome is of going in.
It wasn't the same kind of tackle, though, I didn't think, because against Manchester United. And that, against Manchester United, he had the momentum and he was coming in. And right. He had 2 feet off the floor. And you could say there was excessive force used there.
This time, one foot was stood back.
Yeah, well, he was actually stood still. So there was no force.
But was it
there.
Not still a lunge?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think that's the difference. I don't think this was a lunge. He was stood still. His left foot went out and his right foot was behind him. Right. And it was Wilshere who was flying into him. And Dietmar Hamann made a good point yesterday in that he said, when a player's coming into you, like Wilshere was at speed, one of the best ways to protect yourself is to lift your back foot up so you don't leave that planted and kind of suffer a very bad injury yourself. Mm. Now, I don't know if that's what Kompany was thinking, but his body shape suggested it was a lunge, but there was actually no forward momentum, so I just don't see it.
All right, well, a referee making a mistake in split-second decision, shocker. Mm. For many, though, the biggest scandal of all wasn't so much that. It was the fact that the police apparently went round and collected all those banners that the Man City fans put out saying £62 and we're still here, £62, when will it stop? I mean, it'd be pretty strange if the stewards went round and collected them, because there's nothing particularly offensive there, it's an expression. But the police apparently had threatened to arrest one man who, if he didn't take his banner down. Extraordinary.
That's the first time I heard of that.
Criminals, that's what I heard.
Pardon?
Why aren't they out tracking down real criminals?
Exactly.
Yeah,
and I suppose there is a certain irony of people in a capacity crowd complaining about how much they had to pay to get in. But, it seems very heavy-handed for if the police were doing that, which I was unaware of.
Yep. Mr. Trequartista says, question for Amy on Monday, is Arsene Wenger the man behind Arsenal's seeming inaction on the transfer market? He must see that the squad needs to be strengthened at the moment. Amy?
I think if the next few weeks go really badly, if Arsenal go out of the cup to Swansea and then find themselves a bit knackered and stretched and don't do well in the league games they've got coming up.
He still won't do anything?
No, I think he'll panic buy, but that's sort of the whole point, really.
What would you most like him to buy? Holding midfielder?
A holding midfielder, another goalkeeper and a centre-forward would be nice, but
really?
I suspect
just the spine of the team.
Yes,
all right. Okay, well, you mentioned the fact you've got your third-round replay against Swansea coming up at the Emirates this Wednesday. Fixture hell, because it's one game after another.
It is, yes. But and again, that's where your squad depth gets exposed. And I think a lot of those players will be a little extra tired, having played for so long against Man City with 10 men.
Right.
Abidjar will be just back from a long period out. It'd be doubtful that he's able to play again. Arteta's out injured.
Right.
So
Swansea, of course, coming off a fine draw away to Everton. Swansea to outbid Liverpool Football Club for Blackpool's Tom Ince. Is that something that was in your rumour mill this morning, Barry?
No, it wasn't. Oh. So it could well be true. someone on this podcast, I can't remember who, said at the start of the season that they thought Swansea under Loudrup would be a car crash. It'd
be Sean, won't it?
No, it was me. Yeah, I've been reminded of it on numerous occasions by eagle-eared listeners. Tom Ince would be a good signing. And
do eagles have particularly fine kind of?
Well, if you're going to get that pedantic, I would point out that Lauren Koscielny's foul yesterday on Dzeko yesterday would not be a foul in rugby.
Right. Okay, that's
so
a fair
up
point.
Yours, Jimbo.
No, you're right. But
it would be a good,
cooperation,
quite a good, well, no, a very mediocre tackle.
All right. Anyway, moving on. Old Trafford. Liverpool, second best, Greg.
Second best.
Or did they just start too late?
Well, they started 60 minutes too late. So they were second best from the start. I think essentially Ferguson had done his homework on Liverpool, given the recent performances against them, and he went with a diamond in midfield and a very energetic midfield, and that's right. Where the game was won in the first half. I think Liverpool's midfield malfunctioned. United's diamond kind of tucked in tight and had an extra man against Liverpool, and they just got space in behind them. And I mean, United looked like a team very comfortable with, you know, in their own skin, and kind of the passing and movement was all flowed, all quite organic, and Liverpool just were stuttering and struggling to kind of, you know how to cope with Manchester United in midfield.
Did they do their homework on Man United?
Liverpool? Yeah. I don't think so, no, because essentially what happened is Downing and Sterling were further forward with Suarez, but they weren't really involved enough with him. And then when Liverpool were defending, they were a man down because those two players were too far advanced. They just looked very uncomfortable and they sat back too deep, which has happened a lot of times this season when they've been pressed and they've not been able to deal with it. And United really did play a good pressing game, which they haven't been doing a lot this season. And I think you can say there's a lot of credit to Carrick, to Kagawa, cleverly, and Young, because they essentially allowed Carrick to have the freedom to dictate right. play, and he dictated it very well.
All right, Carrick. Here's Ahmed Mohamed Umar, who says Carrick was quite magnificent against the poor. So why is he always dubbed the little engine that couldn't? But here's Shepas saying, I don't rate him at the top level. I don't think he's rubbish. I've just seen him get completely overwhelmed in Europe on too many occasions. Which should I believe? Is Carrick good or not?
Well, he had a good game against Liverpool. Right. I think with the right players around him, he can be a very good player. But I think United, everybody knows that over the last 3 or 4 years, they haven't really had much energy in midfield. And at times, he's not been able to express himself because he's been having to run around and do the dirty work as well, which he's not as good at.
Right.
I rate Carrick very highly, but and find it baffling that in his entire career he's played less than 20 times for England, which I suppose is a fairly damning indictment on England, right. who aren't, you know, you would think a player of his quality would get more games, but he seems to divide opinion like, you know, more than most footballers.
Right, like the letter N, I like to say.
Yes.
Yep. It's worth mentioning, though, The second half, the turnaround.
Well, I want to ask you about the second half.
Yeah, I mean,
here's my question.
Yeah.
Is it coincidence that they were better after Sturridge came on?
I don't think it is coincidence, no. I think what happened is Suarez in the first half had Vidic and Ferdinandes marking him the whole time, so there was no outlet for Liverpool's midfield when they did get the ball. I think when Sturridge came on, they couldn't ignore him. Yeah, his movement was very good. He was dragging Vidic away from Ferdinand more, which gave either Suarez or Sturridge more space and therefore more options for midfield, so therefore Liverpool could start playing. Also, they went 4-on-4 in midfield, so there was, you know, the game was more evenly matched at that right. point. So, and I think Liverpool played very, very well for that last half an hour. But that's kind of, it's a microcosm of Liverpool season in that they've been, you know, disappointing at times, and you think this isn't going to work out. And then suddenly, towards the end of matches, you think, oh, there's that glint of optimism. There's a bit of hope there. And again, Liverpool fans are probably left thinking at the end of the game, oh, you know, maybe Rodgers will see that and things can improve, and therefore there is a bright future ahead. But it seems to be, you know, most weeks that's the case watching Liverpool. There's
like a mirage.
Something like that. Yeah.
Manchester United were like hanging on by the skin of their teeth at the end. And Rodgers clearly didn't get his tactics right, but was able to correct them. So should we criticise him for not getting them right or praise him for having the gumption and the savvy to be able to fix things during the game?
Well, he's done that against Chelsea and Everton this season as well, and changed games, but I mean,
you're still yet to beat a team from the top.
Exactly, which is that's the thing, you know, ultimately you could praise him, but Liverpool still lost the match. But I do think maybe Sturridge, you know, he showed that he could be a very good signing for Liverpool. His attitude seemed very good. I know
his frown is absolutely spot on.
Yeah.
I was thinking, is there a better frowner in world football?
I don't know. Gerrard's got a good frown on him as well.
Yeah, he has actually. That's quite a formidable combination.
Gerrard's got a very small forehead.
Right. You got any other wrinkled brows you'd like to throw out there, Amy?
I've always thought Lampard's frown's quite decent.
But is it on a Sturridge level? I'm not sure. Sturridge looks really, really, really...
Did you see him on the bench when he was in the first half?
Yes.
Yeah, there was like a chasm between him and Barini on the left. He's just sat there and he looked like, I'm not talking to anyone. And then he came on and
rude on him. Like,
Woof. Very moody.
Huntelaar in the Euros. Oh, really? I'm not so much sure it was a frown, but he d- he really looked cheesed off when he was on the bench.
Right, right. Well, you want that from a player, don't you? You'd be worried if they weren't looking cheesed off on the bench, I think. Brittle, that's a word I'm hearing a lot in relation to Man United at the back, Barry. And, of course, Vidic going off injured again. That's a question, by the way.
Oh, sorry. Well, it isn't a question. It's just a
Oh, he's got
statement.
Me again. Barry 2, Jimbo 0.
1.
1. Go on, Barry.
Yeah.
You corrected me on that. That's Barry 3 now. Jimbo 1.
Manchester United are brittle at the back. They concede a lot of goals.
Right.
And particularly, like, I mean, it's well documented how many times they've had to come from behind this season to snatch late victories, which would suggest Liverpool should have perhaps gone at them early doors yesterday rather than sitting back and letting them attack.
Right.
But, yeah, they will miss Vidic. I don't know how long he's going to be out for.
He was very good. He was very good on
Do we know how long he's going to be out for? Not yet, probably.
No.
Presumably,
by the way,
he's going for his scan today.
He had a look on his face, though. That was the kind of... I've felt this pain before, and it's not a very good pain.
All right. Yeah, I used less when you should have used fewer before, Barry. I didn't want to pick it up at the time, but just if we're counting.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Mali, high stakes in Hollande's war, Johnny Marr goes solo, and our audiobook review looks at Christopher Priest's The Islanders and Daniel Defoe's classic Robinson Crusoe. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Right, back to Football Weekly. And, well, I was going to go with performance of the weekend, Chelsea winning at Stoke. But then, of course, you had that extraordinary comeback by Reading against West Brom. And then, Greg, you point out you had that extraordinary comeback from Barry Glendinning, who was covering and writing a match report of Reading against West Brom, which saw Reading 2-0 down with 8 minutes to go. But then, by Jiminy, they ended up 3-2 winners. How did it all turn around, as far as you can gather?
Reading were just absolutely appalling for 80 minutes. Yep. As poor a performance as I've ever seen from a side in the Premier League.
Really?
Yeah, they showed no fight, no drive, no spirit, even with their free kicks and dead ball deliveries that were going, you know, just put sailing wide or out over the sideline. And
was it a rope-a-dope?
Conceivably. I mean, West Brom should have been 4-0 up anyway. Lukaku was a beast. He was brilliant. Scored 2, rattled the crossbar with a shot and a header off the upright, and he had a goal disallowed for offside as well, which was, you know, a correct decision, but there wasn't much in it. And I mean, after the game, Steve Clarke was completely shell-shocked, and Brian McDermott gave the impression that, you know, we got out of jail with this one. We were lucky, but he was happy to take the look.
How concerned should Steve Clarke be about the run of form his West Brom are now enjoying? Or I say run of form, it's more run of results.
Well, he looked and sounded very concerned after the game and said it was time to worry. Gare is out for the season. Jakob will be missing for a couple of months, possibly. I think he's a torn hamstring. And not sure what's wrong with Long. And Malumbu, you know, he'll be gone for at least a month. So, yeah, he should be very concerned. But that said, they should have won at their leisure on Saturday. But they won't play sides as bad as Reading every week.
Turning point for the Royals, do you think? This is where the comeback begins? The Great Escape? Yeah, Barry?
Well, possibly. They were very lucky on Saturday. Right. Okay. They did not deserve to win that game. But, you know, if their luck has changed, then, and they could continue playing like they did in the last 10 minutes, they could stay up. If they continue playing like they did in the first 80, they are Stonewall certainties to go down.
Mm. All right, then. Performance of the weekend part 2. Could this arguably be Chelsea going to Fortress Britannia and winning 4-0, mittily with a little bit of help from Jonathan Walters? Not sure if that was that the difference, do you think, Amy?
Well, it certainly helped them on their way. I
mean, yeah.
But I thought, watching Lampard putting his penalty away as well, and obviously getting another step up on the Chelsea goal scorers list, it occurred to me, and I don't know the answer to this, but how many clubs have got their greatest goal scorers in their history list, midfielders so high to the top? And we sort of take it for granted because Sorry?
Roma.
Well, thank you very much. Okay. All right. How many, apart from Roma, have gone midfielders so high on the top of the...
Matt Letizia,
oh,
possibly.
All right. See, I've started something here.
I listen to you, Amy.
Yeah. Cheers, Barry.
Sorry.
Yeah. She asked a question.
No, wait, Amy's, sorry, Amy's making a very good point about how many goals Lampard scored from midfield, which is... And it's incredible the amount
just
of goals
in.
He scored.
Yeah, he's staggering in the world of
amateur. Yeah. He's fifth on the all-time Premier League goal scorers list, and that's a midfielder. He's going to overtake Robbie Fowler if he scores another three or four, I think, which is that's pretty good. And he's probably going to score 200 goals for Chelsea as well now. And that's a midfielder who, over the years, a lot of other clubs, if you ask them, you know, would they want to have swapped him for Vieira, Keane, Gerrard, you know, other illustrious midfielders, Scholes, you know, they probably would have said no. Yet you look at Lampard's record, and he's up there with you know, the finest midfielders that have been in terms of, you know, how he plays.
Also racing up the Chelsea all-time scoring charts, of course, is Jonathan Waters. Yeah. In fact, Spanish blogger La Libreta de Van Gaal says he's on course to overtake Fernando Torres. It's interesting to see the Spanish having a bit of a pop at El Nino. What was your point anyway about Lampard all those years ago, Amy?
I just think it was just recognition that, you know, we take it for granted that he's got this great goal-scoring record, but I think a bit of perspective, it just makes it all the more admirable.
All right, Sean Massey, does she ever make a wrong decision?
Not that I've seen.
No, or do they? Maybe they just don't show those ones. Every time they show a Sean Massey incident, it's like, wow!
I know, it's true. She's the only lines person, is that the right word, that gets name-checked. You know, and rather than it just being a good or bad decision from the lines person, it's always... her specifically.
Is it going to be, like, you call it a Massey now, if there's a really good offside decision? Her name is the byword for it.
That'd be nice.
Yeah. Is it women's intuition, do you think, Amy?
What are you asking me for?
Anyway, well, that's remarkable, isn't it? Stoke, who were an absolute... they had only conceded 3 goals at home before Christmas. 8 goals since. 8.
Do you think... Would Tony Pulis have had a go at Jonathan Walters after that game? Or would you just, like, throw a blanket over him and say, there, you know? We all have days like that.
Hmm.
Stan Van den Buys had a worse day than that once. He scored 3 own goals in the Jupiter League playing for Beerschot in a match against Anderlecht.
Did he miss a penalty, though?
But I don't think the missed penalty is that big a deal, because
that's a goal.
Chelsea were out of sight anyway, right, okay. You know.
Apparently Tom Lutz did the minute by minute and said he played very well, apart from all that other stuff. And at the end, you looked at the match ratings, which people had voted, and he had 7.7. And then when we pointed this out, people went on there and dragged him down. Right. But I thought there was something beautiful about him doing that on his 100th Premier League appearance. I mean, if he'd have scored a hat-trick, he probably wouldn't have made the front of the Observer Sport, but he actually made the front page of the Observer Sport by being so, you know.
Right. Such a magnificent failure.
Yeah, such a magnificent failure.
Good. Okay, in other weekend Premier League action, there was the Clint Derby, QPR against Spurs, of course. Good point for QPR.
Yeah, any point's a good point for QPR at the moment. Huh?
Well, they'd have beaten Chelsea and got a point off Spurs, so it's not bad, is it? They're not going to get Loic Remy, because he's going to Newcastle, apparently. That's exciting. But they have signed Habib Habibu, which is funny.
That's a funny name.
Yeah. It is a funny name, because Habib means, like, beloved. So he's beloved.
Habibibibubu.
Debussy and Loic Remy. It's Frenchy stuff for Newcastle, who had a 0-0 draw at Norwich, which, again, is not a bad point for them, isn't it, given the run they've been on?
Yeah, and also two exciting players, I think, for Newcastle. Yeah. I think both two really, really good signings. And, you know, the French league is, as Arsene Wenger pointed out quite recently, is not necessarily the place to go shopping anymore, which it used to be. But Newcastle are still finding a lot of very good value there.
Right. Where is the place to go shopping?
Well, according to Arsene, who doesn't really want to shop anyway, so I don't know why we're listening to that, but he says it's now Germany and Spain and Japan is the emerging market, which the English clubs have a big disadvantage about because of the work permit situation. It's not easy to bring in players that are young from outside the EU.
Oh, okay.
And as they paid 75% of international games, they won't get permits. But Newcastle have, I think Debussy is a really, really excellent attacking fullback.
Cool.
Who I think will fit in nicely to the Premier League. And Remy, I think, will offer a nice width. He can score goals. I'm still interested. I think he might need a bit of adaptation time to the Premier League, but I think he could be a good signing for them as well.
Good news. There. In the Lambert derby, Southampton went and beat Aston Villa, with Ricky Lambert scoring his 31st penalty and a 31 spot kicks. Pretty good stuff. Of course, it wasn't a penalty in the first place, though, were it?
No, it wasn't. Good. It shouldn't have been a penalty. Another incorrect decision. We're getting lots and lots of them.
Although, Nigel Adkins says, yes, there was no contact, but there would have been if Ricky hadn't pulled his... No, it was Jay Rodriguez, wasn't it?
Yeah, Jay Rodriguez.
Yeah. So Nigel Adkins says, yes, there was no contact, but there would have been if Jay Rodriguez hadn't pulled his leg away. And then he does a funny look at the interviewer, like, so checkmate, I think.
All right, and if his aunt had wheels, she'd be a car.
Very much so.
A lot of people were saying that, you know, sometimes the, you know, attackers go down and it isn't actually a dive. But, I mean, you look at this particular one, and I could understand that if somebody's going to get the leg snapped in two, but it was just a dangling leg that was put out there, and he made it look pretty perfect as a dive. I could understand why the referee gave it, because, you know, it took a few looks to just see that there wasn't any contact, because it was so perfectly timed.
Yeah.
There was a sort of a soft penalty in the Blackburn...
Oh, they play Wolves.
Wolves,
yeah,
yes.
It was 1-0, wasn't it?
Friday night, where the attacking player sort of just deliberately wrapped his leg around, you know, had to go out of his way to hook his leg around the defenders and then go down.
And he got it?
He got it, yeah.
All right. Was Michael Appleton already installed for that or not?
No, I believe he watched that game at home on television.
Okay.
So he wasn't even at the ground because he'd only just signed. Anyway, he's probably going to go to another club today or tomorrow to make it his fifth in 14 games.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting to note, as I was reading one paper only this morning, that 8 managerial changes in the Championship this season at clubs beginning with B. Hmm. How about that? Of course, the fact that 6 of them come at Blackpool and Blackburn helps boost those figures, but it's still a remarkable thing. Now, we're going to go back to Villa now, because producer Ben insists they have four games to define their season. Those matches: West Brom away, then Bradford in the second leg of the Capital One Cup, then Millwall away in the FA Cup, and then Newcastle at home. How much attention, given their predicament, are they going to be placing on the cups at this point, Greg?
Probably not that much, because I think it's just imperative that they survive. And I think that game at the weekend, they were perhaps quite unlucky, because they did dominate that game and they did get done by that penalty. They've not had much luck, but they really do need to get the experienced players back. They've badly missed Petrov in midfield, who could, you know, hold things together when things aren't going well for them. And they've also missed Ron Vlahos in defence, and he should be back shortly.
Right.
But I think now it's just all about survival for Villa, and I think the fans will probably stick with Lambert if he keeps them up, because I think he's a young manager who they've seen can do things, you know, like he did at Norwich, and perhaps it wouldn't make sense to go and make another managerial change.
Right. People are calling this the most important transfer window in Villa's history.
What people?
Producer Ben.
Yeah. I thought so.
Imagine they want Bent to be sold. Imagine they need money off
Darren Bent.
Yeah, they need money for Bent, and then they can go and buy some players. But
right.
I don't know if he's managed Bent particularly well. Perhaps, you know,
right.
he's a goal scorer who can score goals, and he's been left out for financial reasons.
That's what they
reasons.
Do, though, isn't it? Goal scorers.
Yeah, they score goals, and he's been left out for financial reasons, because I think if he reaches a certain amount of games, they have to pay more money for him. So
doesn't suggest they've got a big war chest then.
But they do have a lot of sort of overpaid veterans festering in the reserves. You know, Shea Given, Richard Dunn, I think is injured, but he's quite clearly not wanted there anyway.
He's off to the Red Bulls, isn't he?
Oh, is he?
I think so, yeah.
All right.
Anyway.
Sorry, it's just, I don't know, conversations about Aston Villa, I kind of tune out.
Do you?
Yeah, they're one of those clubs, you know, that's totally inoffensive in every way, but just kind of... dull.
Would you like to conclude our Premier League roundup by skipping gaily past Fulham's 1-1 draw with Wigan onto Sunderland's 3-0 win over West Ham?
Ooh.
Yeah, I haven't seen this, so there's not very much I can say about it. I haven't even seen the goals, but it was an excellent win, much needed, and West Ham, I would imagine, must have been pretty poor if they got beat 3-0.
You'd guess so from that scoreline. Yeah. Anybody else got anything more on that? No?
No.
Right. Right. Hey, here's Post of the Week, and it's from a girl. How about that? Jam 893 says, "Dear Jimbo,
you're being very misogynistic today."
I'm not. I'm giving a post.
Tore a cut out of Amy.
I have not.
You've patronised Shan Massey and called her Sean.
I so did
and
not.
And now you're.
I did not patronise her.
Alfred Hitchcock of the podcast world.
I respected her as a lines person. And said it's remarkable how whenever they, you know, say, did the linesman get
that
right?
Would you have made that comment if it was a bloke?
No, the thing about it is, because she is the kind of most visible woman, female lines person, yeah, then you notice more the fact that it's her. But what I noticed the other day when she popped up was the fact that, wow, it's her again. Every time they go to her, she's got something right that you wouldn't have thought was the right decision. It turns out she's right, and she's way ahead of everybody else. So I don't think that's patronising.
Sorry, James, just picking you up on that comment of the week, and it's from a girl.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where does that rate in your patronising scale?
Well, the thing is, Amy, this is something called irony, right? Yeah?
I can't wait for this.
Yeah. So what I was doing was saying, as a joke, it's a girl, because she's actually writing in saying, I had a bet going with a naive friend that you wouldn't mention. No, okay, I'm going to read this bit again. Because she wrote in saying, I had a bet going with a naive friend that you, Jimbo, wouldn't mention the woman's Ballon d'Or winner, who's Abby Wambach, yeah, of the United States, or even hint at the mild controversy of Christine Sinclair's exclusion from the shortlist. Ben, I can't believe you cut that out of the podcast. Shame on you. Anyway, it says at Jam 893. I'm very sorry to say I won that bet. I'm sorry too, Jam 893. That was very ill-prepared of us. It's obvious to me, she continues, that none of you watch women's football for a couple of reasons. The first is not only Barry Glendening's lazy, he went down like a girl when describing the divers who infest the women's game, but then no one ever corrects him when he does it to describe someone like Luis Suarez. Even the most cursory watcher of the women's game knows that women don't roll around on the floor. In general, they don't even end up on the floor. In fact, a main problem with the men's game is that too many men are going down like men. But I digress, says Jam 893. Second reason was that you lot were asked last year by a reader which footballer you'd like to wake up to after a coma. Only Raphael Honigstein had the wit or knowledge to name a lady footballer, Birgit Prinz. It would be him, wouldn't it? Curse you, Honigstein. This is, as it happens, a testament to his fine taste in women. One of you chose Peter Crouch. I'm more afraid from commenting on this choice. No love, Jenny. P.S. When's Amy back? There you go.
I'm flabbergasted by that comment. But what she fails to point out is that maybe the main men that you chose to wake up to after a coma...
I can't remember this conversation at all.
...might genuinely be a male footballer.
Yeah, she's been homophobic.
Well, I'm not sure that she is.
She's accusing me of saying something I'm pretty sure I've never said.
I think you said it last week, actually, Barry, to be fair. And at the time,
I accuse people of crying like girls or screaming like girls. I don't think I've ever said diving like a girl.
All right.
Going down like a girl, I think you say.
Yeah.
Going down like a girl.
And I would never go up against a woman when memory's on the line, because they...
Yeah, that's a fair point. Now you're being sexist again.
No, I'm full of admiration.
Your little segment here isn't even the most bizarre gender reference in the last week in football.
All right, let's hear that then.
The Rangers chairman, Charles Green, who is going to try and use a sexual discrimination law to move Rangers from the Scottish Premier League into another league, whether that's in England or elsewhere, because he says the precedent has been set that a women's football team in Belgium plays cross-border in Holland.
All right.
So, he says he's going to use this gender law or something to try and get Rangers into the Premier League.
So if a women's team can do it, but isn't it up to the discretion of the league involved? So it doesn't matter what the law says.
Well, I think he's saying it's under UEFA. It's under UEFA laws, and he's going to sue UEFA with this gender law. I mean, he could be just...
So they're going to play in a women's league where?
They're going to play in the Dutch women's league and hope to get into the Champions League through fourth place, you know.
All right. Cool. Anyway, back to Jam 893, and that was the end of her actually, there's a little bit more of that, but we went on about Messi's super. Yeah, you're absolutely spot on, and we do apologise for that. You'll be excited to know that big things are afoot for the upcoming European Women's Championship in Sweden this summer, in June, as we all know. Big things.
Are we going?
Big things, Barry. Big things. Now, Mimoko says, when's when are non-Guardian staff participations? Why are they not more this year? Rafael, Philippe, Fernando, etc. Philippe's in on Thursday. How about that? Kayaking says, can you just spend the whole pod discussing Messi's past? No, but I know a man who could, Sid Lowe in Spain. And after this, we might be hearing from him if he picks up. No Sid, listeners, but Amy's got a top stat. Amy.
Well, this is I specifically brought this in for Barry.
Right.
So that next time he notices with his eagle eyes as well as his eagle ears that Mike Dean happens to be refereeing an Arsenal game, he can take this into account, that Arsenal's record under said referee is played 17, won 1, drawn 7, lost 9. And on top of that, which is just Premier League, you've got the League Cup final catastrophe against Birmingham City and against Bradford.
Wow, so that's
get on that. If anybody out there notices
one win,
Mike Dean is reffing an Arsenal game. This is not to say that he wasn't justified in sending off Koscielny or any such stuff.
Right, okay, cool.
Just for the betters out
there. How about that? Messi. Did you see his pass?
I saw his pass. It was a fantastic pass, yeah.
Fabregas's run was pretty fantastic. My thought was that you needed the pass, needed the run, and the run needed the pass. Mm. And so it was a great bit of teamwork between Cesc and
it was. And
could you describe it, Greg?
Messi picked the ball up just past the semicircle at the halfway line, and there were three defenders which were kind of between Fabregas and the ball. And like you say, Fabregas timed his run to perfection, but Messi's pass was kind of lofted over them with a perfect bit of curl coming inside, so it kind of just landed perfectly in Fabregas's path and he finished, but it was a
delight.
The way
he flicked it as well, he kind of looked one way then the other, went I'll do this then
and I imagine he it's the kind of thing that players do a lot in training but wouldn't necessarily have the guts to do in a match, but Messi he's Messi, isn't he? So he is Messi.
There was a stat during the rounds this weekend, you see this, Amy? He's had more assists, he's provided more assists than any player in the last 5 years in the major European leagues. And that means most goals and most assists.
I know. You wonder if...
Imagine if he played in goal as well.
The other thing about Messi is that he's so understated.
Mm.
And his personality, the way that he is. You just wonder how we'd all feel about him if he was a bit more of a sort of typical footballing egomaniac type
of character. I can't think of another example. Like a similar player in Spain who would give us a... No. Okay.
You can't feel ambivalent about him, can you? You can't sort of judge his playing against his personality and that clouds your judgment because he's such a
cuddly
comes
little
across. Yeah.
Yeah.
When is the last time he went through anything resembling a goal drought?
Well, he had two games or something, didn't he, when he didn't score?
I would say minimum three to constitute a drought.
For this at the moment, he's only scoring a goal a game, I think, isn't he? And that's kind of poor by his standards, so something's clearly up there. So Malaga were the opponents and they were dispatched in a short shrift by Barca, and that's now 55 points they've picked up from 19 matches. So they've had basically 18 wins and a draw, and it's absolutely unprecedented and amazing. While Real blew up again, they're now 18 points behind. They were playing the team bottom of the league, Osasuna, who hadn't won in 6 matches. They didn't have Ronaldo. They did put Modric on, and he struggled rather. Kaká came on, got a red card, which is pretty remarkable. And I think they managed their first shot on goal in the 93rd minute or something ridiculous like that. But anyway.
And they're now 4 points behind Atletico, and they've played a game more. So, quite worrying.
It's not just the title, but second place looks like something of an ask at present.
Mm.
It was a great moment in Udinese-Fiorentina when Udinese were awarded a penalty and Toto Di Natale stepped up to take the kick. But Aquilani did that thing of trying to muss up the penalty spot, so Di Natale kicked him up the bum.
Did Aquilani go down screaming?
Aquilani's out for 3 months.
Yeah, exactly.
Big win that for Udinese, 1-2 in a row. Fiorentina losing again. They're a top three challenge, beginning to falter a little bit. But long way to go in that race. You might have noticed that Juve dropped points again, this time at Parma, 1-1 draw. The absence of Chiellini looking more and more crucial. It was Chiellini's replacement, Cáceres, who allowed Parma's substitute Sansoni to wander past him and slot the equaliser home after they'd taken a slightly fortuitous free kick lead through Andrea Pirlo, fortuitous because it bounced off a Parma defender's head. But anyway, so that means they've now picked up 1 point from 2 games. Yikes. Right, Milan in the meantime were rubbish, and they drew 0-0 away at Sampdoria in a match which I watched in the company of Edgar Davids of Barnet.
Was he on a scouting mission for them?
I'm not sure. He just got back from Rotherham, where they beat promotion-chasing Rotherham. Right. Good.
Were you round his house, or was he round your house?
No, we
were. Or
were
you in a television studio?
Exactly, Barry. Exactly. Exactly.
You say he was a lot smaller.
Yeah, he was smaller, a lot thinner than I remembered him.
Nice bloke.
Well, I think he would. You know, nobody got hit.
Yeah. That's kind.
There was a slightly awkward moment early on when I said something about Pirlo and your old friend Pirlo, because of course they played together. Well, I think they played against each other, although they featured at the same clubs but at different times. And he just said, "He's not my friend."
You know, you say Edgar Davids was a lot smaller in real life. Most footballers generally are when you meet them, aren't they? They look a lot smaller.
I remember once meeting Claudio Caniggia and being really alarmed at how small he was.
Right, he's funny because he was often quite high. That's really poor.
He always reminds me of Axl Rose.
Who?
Claudio Caniggia?
Caniggia,
yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Anyway, he's quite small.
Is he?
Yes.
I once met Sammy Hippier in a sauna.
Okay.
And he was a lot bigger in real life.
No.
Height-wise. Height-wise, yeah. He was on... I was in this sauna in Liverpool in the... what's it called? The David Lloyd gym.
Oh, right.
I was just in there, sat there, you know, sweating as you do.
And did you talk to him?
Yeah, and I looked behind me and it was Sammy Hippier and he was just laid out on the deck at the back, just having a sauna. And it was just before Liverpool played Barcelona and drew 0-0 at the Nou Camp. So I had a little chat with him about football and he was a lovely fella.
Right.
And then I went into the pool and he followed me in there and he had a swim about and I had another chat with him about football. And then his missus came over and started shouting at him and telling him to get out and they had a big argument upstairs in the restaurant. That's it. And
The whole question of sauna etiquette is an interesting one.
Right.
I mean, if you're in a sauna and you're not wearing a great amount and there's lots of other people who you may not know also wearing not a lot.
Well, I don't know which kind of sauna you're in, though. I mean, if you're in the David Lloyd, you just wear your shorts and then go and have a swim. If you're in Japan, you generally don't wear anything, so it depends.
In a women's sauna, Amy, how does that work? Paint us a picture.
No, well, I'm with you here, Greg. You know, most saunas in England, you keep swimwear on.
Mm. Right.
But, you know, saunas elsewhere, you don't. And my friend who's in Finland, of course, where Sami Hyypiä is from, says that the etiquette in Finland is quite bizarre because that's where you tend to not wear anything in the sauna. And people sit there and will gladly chat away about
small where the
talk.
Romans did all their
whereas,
business, wasn't
whereas
it,
if
the
they're
baths.
Sitting on the bus or in the tube, they won't talk to one another.
Right.
Mm. Interesting.
Right. Well, I guess with the removal of barriers in a physical sense might facilitate the removal of barriers in a social sense as well.
Yeah. I just don't like saunas.
No, I don't like them either. Sweaty places. Did Hippier's wife shout at him in Finnish or English, Greg?
She shouted at him in Finnish.
And how did you know they were having an argument?
She was very angry with him.
Some languages sound like... Yeah, and Spanish, for example,
she
people
was,
can sound
she
quite
wasn't,
heated.
She wasn't
that.
Your typical footballer's a wag type either. She was very stocky, heavy-set lady, very pale, and maybe that's how, you know, how the women are in Finland, and she hooked him out.
They must have a heck of a football team.
No, I'm just being honest. This is
the hook, Jimbo.
No, she was pale. Like that just means she was pale. She didn't have much of a tan. She was quite heavy set, and she looked like, you know, she could give him a good clout.
Got a spade, don't you?
Yeah,
a little.
Yeah, there's a chute somewhere, and I can just fly down the atrium and into
well,
the
I saw Paul Walsh.
Oh yeah,
he was at the Reading game. You know, former Liverpool and Spurs player who now works for Sky. And he's very, very.
Small.
Yeah.
He's tiny, yeah. I mean,
it's difficult to imagine how he could have had such a successful career as a striker, and a pretty tough one too, because he's really, you know, a pocket rocket.
Mm. Yeah. There you go. Excitingly, that's not quite it for today's podcast, because I mentioned way back at the start about the real Super Sunday clash, and it took place in Portugal. Benfica taking on Porto. Would you believe neither of these teams had dropped points since September? Wow. And they came face to face.
And what happened?
Well,
I genuinely don't know. So this is going to be a surprise for me.
It ended 2-2. Well worth seeking out. I'm not sure if it was the first or the second goal. Basically, there were four goals in the space of about 20 minutes. So that's the bit of the game you want to watch. Particularly the goal by Benfica's Nemanja Matic. There you go. So well done to both sides because it was a draw. Fantastic. And that,
why did you tell us that?
Because I just thought it was remarkable. I imagine teams that hadn't dropped points, not just hadn't lost, but hadn't dropped points in September. That's crazy.
But you were building it up to... I thought it was going to be some sensationally amusing story. But
imagine, Barry, if you were following Portuguese football. Since September, there would have been one story dominating things. These two teams who were just winning game after game after game after game. And then, finally, in January, they come face to face. That's a big story. Admittedly, told that way, it's a little bit more exciting. I kind of threw it away. But that's my bad. Not Portuguese footballs.
No.
Don't hate the player, hate the game. No, the other way around in this case.
Don't hate the game, hate Jimbo.
Yep. Yep. Okay. That's it for today. We will be back on Thursday with all the midweek action. Arsenal, Swansea, Chelsea, Southampton, that Premier League game they've got to make up. Mm-hmm.
Man United, West Ham, FA Cup replay.
Oh, yeah, that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And we'll also be in the company of Philippe Auclair and Jonathan Wilson, looking forward to Africa Cup of Nations.
And the latest from Finland.
Yeah, well, yeah, we'll have the excited responses from...
Angry Finnish women. I love Finnish women and everything about them, and I think they look great.
Hey, Greg, we all do. Okay, then, that's Football Weekly. Many thanks, Barry Glendinning, producer Ben, Greg Bukowski, and Amy Lawrence. And we will speak to you soon. Bye-bye.